Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Iraq. He has also served as assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration, with a special focus on Iran. Previously at the State Department, he served as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the Department of State, where his responsibilities included leading the Iran policy team and coordinating public diplomacy. He has an article at the Wall Street Journal with Sona Kaptai, The Islamist Feud Behind Turkey's Turmoil. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador James Jeffrey.
Thank you very much, Ian. Glad to be here.
And it looks as though this feud that's going on between Prime Minister Erdogan and his former spiritual muse, Fethullah Gulen, is threatening Erdogan's political future, and it's shaking the very foundation of the Justice and Development Party. So how could this self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania have this kind of influence?
Well, first of all, Erdogan and Fethullah Gulen represent somewhat different forms of, if you will, modern political Islam. Gulen is more of a Sufi Islamic theologian, and he comes from a distinctly Anatolian base. Most of the Justice Party, Erdogan's party, associates itself with the Muslim Brothers, who, of course, started in the 1920s in Egypt. So there's a little bit of difference between the two. But up until now, they have joined ranks against what you could call a secular state, the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, and particularly the military's interference. Having basically excluded the military and certain other institutions from power, and based upon the extraordinary economic success of the Turkish state in the last 12 years, they've come to dominate the entire landscape, not just the political landscape. But now you have a battle within the party for overall control of the party and, frankly, of the state.
And according to your Wall Street Journal article that you wrote with Sona Kaptai, The Islamist Feud Behind Turkey's Turmoil, what in effect happened is that the liberal and secular protesters against the desecration, as they saw it, of Gezi Park by developers, and I guess the development part of the AKP might be a part of that, they started a sort of revolution, but now the Gulenists, if that's the way to describe them, seem to be joining with the liberal and secular people against the prime minister.
Exactly. What we see here, and we've seen it in Maliki's Iraq, we saw it in Morsi's Egypt, and frankly, we saw it in the Third Reich in Germany, is a tendency of societies that have not totally evolved into liberal, tolerant, enlightenment constructs to push a democratic system into a majority rule where whoever holds the most votes, to quote Prime Minister Erdogan the other day, one out of every two people vote for me, so basically we can do whatever we think is best for the state, to exclude from power, exclude from influence any other pluralistic element in the society. This has been going on for some time in Turkey, and now you're seeing those last elements, the liberal public opinion represented by the Gezi Park protests and the Gulenist movement, essentially quasi-closing ranks to resist this. In the Götürdemirung, if you will be the March elections in Istanbul.
But in a sense, Erdogan's alleging is that the police officials and the prosecutors belong to Gulen, and that he, in effect, is trying to establish a state within a state. And he does have a movement whose net worth is estimated over $25 billion and with direct and partial ownership of over 200 charitable foundations. So he's not without resources.
No, absolutely. Both sides have tremendous resources they can call upon. And while the corruption charges may have been manipulated by the Gulenists, particularly in the timing, there's absolutely no doubt that there isn't fire behind this smoke, that there is fire behind this smoke. These charges, the amounts of money involved, the high-level people who have been implicated, all point to a very serious corruption scandal that every independent analyst, Turkish analyst I know, believes actually occurred, that this isn't something made up either in Washington, which is the accusation of many in Erdogan's party, or in Pennsylvania with Mr. Gulen.
Well, this has prompted President Obama, apparently, to get onto the phone with Erdogan and saying, you know, cut it out. You know, we have nothing to do with this. You know, just because this guy's in Pennsylvania doesn't mean the U.S. government is manipulating him. That, I take it that's what the White House is telling Erdogan.
I'm sure it is, but it's falling on deaf ears. Just today, almost all of the major pro-government papers ran a particularly despicable story accusing former General Petraeus of being behind the entire thing.
So, but what is real, apparently, is that there is real involvement from Iran in this scandal, and that is the extent to which Erdogan's cabinet members and cronies cozied up to an Iranian businessman, Reza Zarab, who's married to a famous Turkish pop star. And he apparently was a cutout for the Iranian IRGC, I guess, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the Ministry of Intelligence, I think, more specifically, to break the sanctions regime in Iran, so that a lot of people within Erdogan's cabinet were essentially getting kickbacks from breaking the international sanctions against Iran. Is that what's going on?
Only very generally. First of all, we're not talking about international sanctions here. We're talking about U.S. Legal sanctions under U.S. congressional action. And these sanctions imposed penalties, not legal penalties so much as penalties in terms of doing business with American banks, doing business in the American economic system for entities that were violating U.S. sanctions, very different from international ones, which have the force of law if passed by the Security Council. And here it involves the Halk Bank, which is a state-owned bank that was involved in gold trade with Iran. Now, depending upon which month we're talking about and what specific activity, that may have been a violation of the U.S. sanctions. Again, nothing illegal from the standpoint of Turkish or international law, but a problem for the U.S., or it may not have been. But the key question is, what were the Iranians doing with these officials, perhaps not trying to undercut U.S. sanctions, but perhaps basically pursuing an activity that benefited the Iranians and enriched a lot of people in Turkey?
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Iraq. He has an article in the Wall Street Journal with Sona Chaptai, The Islamist Feud Behind Turkey's Turmoil. Well, it does seem, though, that Fethullah Gulen, in exile here in the United States with a tremendous following and think tanks and ties to the education system in Turkey, he has been warning his former protege, I guess, at least in a spiritual sense, Erdogan, for some time, that problems have been brewing, the rising corruption in real estate deals. He's also apparently warned him about these cronies involved with breaking sanctions with Iran, and also with deteriorating ties between Turkey and Israel. And I find it surprising that Gulen apparently warned Erdogan to let the Israelis know about that 2010 Gaza humanitarian aid mission that went awry with the Turkish ship that the Israeli commando stormed. And apparently Erdogan ignored those warnings. So tell me about Gulen then, in the sense that he's apparently, even though he's described as a kind of an Islamic version of Opus Dei, it does seem that his brand of Islam is less nationalistic and more inclusive and involved in trying to do interfaith connections. Am I correct?
Well, the fact that he's in exile here in the United States speaks for the fact that he's not negatively disposed towards the U.S. But I don't want to turn him into a hero or, portray him in a different light. Whether he warned Erdogan or not about the Mavi Marmara ship off the coast of Israel, that remains to be seen. But believe me, plenty of people did give him warnings about it, and they were disregarded. The point is that the The movement sees itself threatened by a state that will use the instruments of the state against followers of Gulen, against Gulen's institutions, most recently the Dursani, the basically preparatory schools that he and his businessmen friends have set up around the country. And they fear that he is amassing power in the run-up to the 2014 elections, where Erdogan will change the constitutional system and become a political president as opposed to the apolitical version they have now in the Constitution, and dominate the society and do essentially whatever he wants. Now, that is the Gulenist view. Whether that is reality or not, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, that's also prevailing suspicion that a lot of critics of the Arab Spring and democracy in Islamic states have always made that argument that the Islamists believe in one vote, one person, one vote, one time, and that they cite what happened in Algeria. So are you saying that this is, this, at least according to the Gulenists, this is where Turkey's heading?
I think that there are people who worry about that. I'm more optimistic. I think that if the AK, or Justice Party of Mr. Erdogan, lost a vote, they would live with the results. I have no doubt about that. But I do think that a lot of people are simply very concerned about the amassing of power, the dominance of all institutions, not just the political ones, by one party, and, frankly, the very, I would have to say, rapid reaction of many of the government leaders, including Mr. Erdogan, to any possible challenge, any possible accusation, any possible protest or other action that he deems to be not in accordance with his way forward, which, by the way, has been a very successful way in many respects.
But he does have a hot potato on his southern border, does he not, Erdogan, and the country itself with Syria? Now, my understanding is
hot potatoes.
Yeah, well,
Syria is one of them.
Right.
But Syria is relatively under control. This is not a war that would easily spread into Turkey. Uh-huh. It can easily spread, and is, into Lebanon and Iraq. You do not have an Arab population in Turkey. You do not have the same kind of Sunni-Shia split that you have in Lebanon and Iraq. Nonetheless, he's committed very strongly to a very specific position, the overthrow of Mr. Assad. He supported a lot of people who, in some cases, cooperate with the al-Qaeda folks. And his prestige is on the line to see some kind of result. But it doesn't look like we're going to get one soon.
Well, that, I think, doesn't that speak to the fact that he had a personal relationship with Assad prior to Assad cracking down on democratic protests and turning this situation into the vicious and disgusting civil war that it's become? Apparently, my understanding is that Erdogan is personally slighted, and that this is personal foreign policy, in effect, that he's conducting, that he's, because he's so mad at his former friend, this is the direction of the foreign policy, even if it hasn't been effective. Is that correct?
I think you're on target, but nonetheless, he's also very angry at the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mr. Maliki. He was very angry at Shimon Peres, you'll remember, at Davos in 2009. He tends to personalize his relationships with leaders in the region, and these relationships tend to go in a bad direction.
But in the overall sense, then, of Turkey's image as a modern, a model of governance in the post-Arab Spring Middle East, it would seem that these events of late have tarnished that notion, have they not?
Well, I might have, while in government, pushed the model a bit. I'm not a real believer in it, because countries, even the United States, can't be so much models as perhaps examples or alternative paths forward. Turkey is still a very successful country. It's a constitutional rule of law democracy. It will come out of this crisis. Nonetheless, what has been tarnished is the reputation of the governing party, and it's going to have to take a remedial action very, very quickly, or it's going to suffer at the polls, as it is already suffering in terms of economics. The fall of the Turkish lira, the drop in investment, the increase in its current account deficit, all of these things do not augur well for the Turkish economy, and they all can be traced to Turkey's mark not selling well internationally because of these problems, beginning with Gezi.
And prior to this, of course, there's been the long-running difficulty of Turkey joining the EU. And where does that stand now? Because the secularists, obviously, and the liberals want that. They don't seem to be in the driving seat. The French, I think, have been particularly unhelpful. What's your sense of whether there will be any movement towards Turkey joining the EU?
Well, there is continued movement. In fact, new chapters in the telephone book-like package of EU requirements have just been opened, which is a step forward. But nonetheless, while there was and to some degree still is a strong will by Turks across the ideological and religious spectrum to become a member of the European Union, Turks feel themselves as Europeans. They're in NATO. They're in the Council of Europe. They're in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. They are in a customs union with the EU, and they've been involved in this negotiation for 40 years, off and on. And they feel slighted and humiliated by the fact that Europeans block them for either superficial political reasons, opposition by Greece and Cyprus, or underneath all of this, fears by many in Europe that Turks are too Islamic and too poor and too many to come into the EU, whereas, in fact, Turkey, all in all, is doing better economically than the European Union as a whole right now.
Well, Ambassador James Jeffrey, I thank you so much for joining us here today and filling us in on what seems to be an ongoing struggle, right? This is we've only seen the beginning of this, right?
We certainly haven't seen the end of it.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Iraq. He's also served as assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration with a special focus on Iran. Previously at the State Department, he served as principal deputy assistant secretary for the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the Department of State, where his responsibilities include leading the Iran policy team and coordinating public diplomacy. He has an article at the Wall Street Journal with Sona Kaptai, the Islamist feud behind Turkey's turmoil. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the bombings in the south of Russia, 400 miles from Sochi, and Putin's vow to exterminate the Islamists.